This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. 50 years ago, in 1975, New York City almost went bankrupt. What if I told you that the Big Apple's fiscal foobar isn't just a cautionary tale from the past, but a very real preview of what might happen again and soon? And I'm not just talking about the surprise victory of self-described socialist Zoran Mamdani in the city's Democratic primary for mayor, although that's part of it. My guest today is Richard E. Farley, author of Drop Dead, a history of how the richest city in America got addicted to spending, saturated in debt, and crashed the municipal bond market, and then managed to get a federal bailout in the nick of time. Farley argues that the same conditions are reemerging today. Runaway budgets, gimmicky accounting, overpromised entitlements, and politicians more interested in ideology than basic arithmetic. And Farley wrote all this before the rise of Mamdani, who promises to blow spending through the roof, enact new taxes, and create masses of new regulations. If you want to understand what it takes to bankrupt a city, listen up, because New York and a city closer to you might be sleepwalking into another fiscal disaster, and this time, there might not be a bailout waiting. Here is The Reason Interview with Richard E. Farley. Richard E. Farley, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me.
You work in the world of finance and all of this. Like, what is your best estimate of if Mamdani wins in the fall and he gets his, you know, he runs the table, he gets to do everything he wants.
Yep.
What happens to the population of New York?
Well, let's talk about what happens to the fiscal situation and the taxes, because that will drive a lot of it. And also, there's one thing we need to talk about, too, which is law and order.
Right.
I think that if you increase the budget by 20 to 25 billion, which I think he's clearly capable of doing, we're not even talking about the nonsense about grocery stores, although he's only saying five or six grocery stores.
Yeah.
So that's probably a sidebar. If you increase the budget by 20 billion, which I think he's capable of doing, that's an increase of 15 to 20% in a time where every projection says revenue is going to decrease.
Right.
If you throw into that taxes, that will drive people to New Jersey, Westchester, et cetera.
Or totally out of the area.
That could create a structural deficit of equal to that.
Right.
That money's not coming from the federal government as long as Trump's there and there's a Republican Congress or even one house of a Republican
Congress. And I mean, part of what you argue in the book is the bigger difference, too, is New York is still the fourth most populous state, but it is no longer in play. I mean, what's amazing to be reminded of in reading Drop Dead is that New York would sometimes vote Republican, sometimes vote Democrat.
It was a swing state. Call it 88.
And now everybody knows, like, Democrats can say fuck you, and Republicans can certainly say fuck you, right? Because it's not coming their way.
Now, I think no one will allow New York City to devolve into chaos. There will be a bailout at some point. The issues under consideration are what would those conditions be?
Yeah.
And when you have to worry about winning the nomination in 1976, you have to treat New York with a little bit of kid gloves. If you don't have to worry about that because a Democrat doesn't, you know, couldn't lose it if he tried or she tried, and a Republican couldn't win it if he or she tried, you can play politics the other way.
Yeah.
And being more draconian.
Right.
So that's something to keep an eye on. But I think the real issue of whether or not you lose people in New York and degradate the tax base to create a very serious fiscal crisis quickly is if people feel unsafe in New York City.
Right. Okay. And by that, you don't mean financially, you mean physically.
It's partly that, but also physically. If I have a Marxist in Gracie Mansion, I wonder if the Marxist will live in Gracie Mansion. I don't know. And I think he is a Marxist. I mean, he says, I want to seize the means of production. I think you trust people when they say these things. You know, who also says things like globalize the intifada. And then won't really back off of that in a way that decries violence. What will the policing policies be? Will there be, you know, he's never really backed off of defund the police in an aggressive way. He won't say he'll keep Ms. Tish on as policeman, who now I think is maybe the most popular political figure in the city, if you want to call the police commission a political figure.
Well, you absolutely should. And, you know, there has been, I mean, this is also something to think about. Nationwide, there's been a decline in violent crime year over year. It's, you know, people are talking about it's going to be the biggest single thing.
you know, clearly policing matters, but it's not clear exactly how much. But you're basically saying if we get a guy who is a defund the police, you know, a romancer of revolutionary violence,
yes.
Things are going to get hairy.
I don't know. I think there's a risk of that.
Yeah.
He's a bit of an empty vessel.
Mm-hmm.
He's 33 years old. He's a bit of a dilettante, in my judgment. He's relatively new to city politics.
Right.
Never really run anything. He is very glib. He's very handsome. He's charismatic.
Yeah.
But what does he really stand for and mean? And when you have the executive function of overseeing the largest police force in the city, in the country rather, in a city where there's a thin veneer of law and order, we saw that in 2020.
Right.
Doesn't take much for street gangs to go down and decide they're going to loot and make a lot of money and off of a ineffective law enforcement apparatus.
Okay, so the book is Drop Dead, How a Coterie of Corrupt Politicians, Bankers, Lawyers, Spinmeisters, and Mobsters Bankrupted New York, Got Bailed Out, Blamed the President, and Went Back to Business as Usual, and It Might Be Happening Again.
I have no responsibility for the subtitle.
Okay, but you know what? You got to own
one of the longest of all.
I don't know that I need to read any more in the book after that, but this is about the fiscal crisis in New York City in 1975.
Correct.
Can you summarize quickly what was happening in New York that brought, you know, the biggest city in America to the brink of bankruptcy?
Yeah, I think the larger quantity of factors affected all large industrial northern Midwestern cities. Mm-hmm. Recession of 1973, 1974, rising interest rates, the cutback in aid from Washington, LBJ's poverty programs, et cetera, being
kind of sunset,
scaled back by Nixon. You had a longer term impact of the hemorrhaging of industrial jobs, really starting in the late 40s, but accelerating.
The peak year for industrial jobs as a percentage of the economy was in the late 40s.
Correct. Yep. I think New York was still the leading industrial city until about 48, 49. Right. You had, even though the low-skilled jobs were moving out, you had an influx of low-skilled workers from the South escaping discrimination, and from Puerto Rico, obviously looking for a higher standard of living. You had a similar exodus of white ethnic working class voters. So you had this shift in demographics and economic impact, which would have been a problem
no matter what.
No matter what.
But in a lot of ways, I mean, one of the things you're arguing is that, yeah, that's true. And it was true everywhere in older established cities. But the real problem was what was going on
in
the New York City budget.
You can discuss it a number of different ways, but there were two things unique to New York. One was the chicanery, the accounting shenanigans, the budgetary fraud, the illegal incurrence of debt to mask deficits.
Right.
So we'll put that in one bucket. That's, of course, the most fun to talk about.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if we're not going to talk about chicanery and characters, you know, we might as well
and,
write about librarians of the 1970s.
What was going on in New York City was also mirrored at the state level under Nelson Rockefeller.
Correct.
Right? Where
not quite as bad, but on a larger scale.
But basically what we saw is, you know, and throughout many states, many cities, there was just a commitment to spend a lot more money than was coming in.
And to use what were previously thought to be unethical, perhaps even illegal means of doing so. Of course, Nelson Rockefeller, famous for the moral obligation bond, which through John Mitchell
ended
explain
up spreading
that
across. For a second.
Way back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, when a government wanted to issue debt, it issued it under the full faith and credit of the state, the city, what have you, okay? And all jurisdictions had constitutional limits or legal limits on how much you could incur. Beginning in the 1920s, because they didn't want to get the referendum vote, which you needed from the voters to approve that kind of debt, and voters at some point were going to say no more, they came up with agency debt, which was the state of New York, for example, forms a subsidiary, calls it the Port Authority. And the Port Authority or the Tri-Borough Authority issues the debt. And the debt is paid by real sources of revenue that have been deferred from the state to that entity.
Right.
Tunnel and bridge tolls,
port
road
fees,
tolls, port
all this
fees.
Kind of stuff.
And those bonds were what they call self-liquidating, which means a bond investor looks at the projections of the tolls and other revenue, stadium authorities, ticket sales, and says, okay, this will more than repay my debt. I'll buy the bonds. Nelson Rockefeller, starting in the early 60s, took an idea that a lawyer named John Mitchell came up with for a federal government education program to build schools.
And this is not just any John Mitchell.
Oh, no, this is the John Mitchell future, Watergate fame and Martha Mitchell fame and all kinds of fame. John Mitchell came up with an idea that said, even if you want to borrow for programs that won't repay themselves, like low-income housing, you can get bond buyers to buy it as long as you convince them with a wink and a nod that the state will stand behind it.
Yeah.
Well, responsible people like the controller of the state at that point, Arthur Levitt, said, oh, wait a minute. If the state's going to stand behind it, you have to get a referendum. There's no winking and nodding here. But Nelson Rockefeller loved the wink and the nod.
Right.
And they came up with something where they explained it to the market by saying the state's not legally obligated to repay your debt. But if the program doesn't generate enough revenue, it's morally obligated.
Right.
And the governor agrees to submit a bill to the legislature to require the state to make good on the debt. And the market bought off on it.
Yeah.
So you basically—
Why did the market do that? Is it because they were like, hey, you know what? The economy is booming. You know, there's some bust, but like— We're still in
there
the
are different
boom.
Theories on that. I think the biggest theory was they were convinced in 1961, I think, when it first came in, that the political power of Nelson Rockefeller and his allies in the state of New York would make good on this debt.
Yeah. And this was also 1961 was the last year that New York was the most populous state in the country.
Correct.
Right? Because by 62, I believe California overtook it, which is a big backdrop of what's happening in New York City.
Just to back up one second. Yeah. Of course, the rating agencies are always around these things too. Right. And the rating agencies bought off on rating these bonds and giving them a decent rating. So you've got the sort of creep where the politicians say, wink and a nod, the rating agencies say, okay, well, we'll take that and give it a good rating. And then the market says, fine. And once you have the precedent of a bond deal being priced appropriately in the marketplace, then the sky's the limit.
Okay. And, you know, starting in the late 50s, early 60s, New York City also, again, following different parts of the country, just said, you know what, let's spend more.
Correct.
And you write in the book, and this is, you know, it's I guess it's not surprising, but it remains shocking that New York City in the 70s was spending more per capita than any other city in the country.
Yes.
What was it spending it on?
Well, the difference, we talked about two differences between New York and other cities.
Right.
And of course, other cities didn't have a fiscal crisis. Mm-hmm. One was the chicanery. The other was New York City took on more obligations and responsibilities than any other city in the country.
Right.
What are we talking about? Its own university system. Well, you had a state university system, SUNY, which is very large.
Yeah.
You have private universities. You have Catholic university. Okay. You had a hospital system. Well, that may have made sense before Medicare.
Right.
But why do you need, and Medicaid, why do you need a hospital system when you have the federal funding of private hospitals? They ran the courts. Until 68, they ran the subways. You may say to yourself, well, why would a city take on this responsibility given the fiscal issues that entails? Well, it's very simple. It's called patronage jobs. Yeah. You know, they want Democratic politicians in New York to be able to hand out those jobs and those contracts and those goodies,
and
not Democratic politicians in Albany.
So New York had an incredibly bloated budget.
Correct.
And everybody, I mean, one of the takeaways from the book is that, you know, in the early 70s or through the mid 70s, basically everybody who lived in New York was getting multiple foreign streams of revenue from the city.
Correct.
Either they worked for it, they might have had a no-show job, or they were benefiting from some other kind of stream.
So two things to keep in mind. One is when Mayor Wagner gave the unions the right to collective bargaining, that really transformed the dynamic of the relationship between the cities and the unions. Victor Gottbaum said very bluntly in 1967, we have the power to elect our own boss.
Right.
And over the course of the Wagner administration into the Lindsay administration and into Beam, you saw increased benefits to public employee unions.
And this also was reflected a national trend because it was JFK
the dynamics
who signed
the same,
off
right?
on collective bargaining for
right?
public unions, et
And
cetera.
If you count the number of votes of public employee union yeah. members and their immediate family members who are of voting right. age, that's enough votes to win just about every Democratic primary for mayor.
Right.
And going back all the way to 67.
Yeah.
So when you have that sort of power and influence, when you realize that, you then your demands become greater and greater, right. and the pressure to accede to those demands obviously becomes overwhelming.
And so you sign off, you meaning, you know, Abe Beame and the city council and everybody in a political job is like, okay, yeah, we're going to give more money to more voters.
Correct.
And then we're going to use these bullshit techniques to cover
Correct.
It up.
And the overwhelming political imperative to not take away from
right.
the voting citizens is really, if you want to put your finger on one thing, it's that.
Yeah.
It's easier to never give in the first place than it is to take away.
Right.
And once you have this enormous smorgasbord of government right. financed programs, which help the middle class, by the way, much more than the poor.
Yeah, no, both right. On both ends, right? Like yeah. they're the ones who use the parks or and use CUNY ultimately or
Correct.
City College.
Correct.
But they're also the ones getting the jobs.
And working in the hospitals as doctors right. and nurses and orderlies.
Yeah.
And
well, this
and,
is the biggest misconception, right?
And the
welfare
union workers
is a
themselves
middle class
are very well
program.
Paid middle. I come right. from a family of teachers union folks.
Yes. Although not in the New York
No,
area,
this was up in Providence.
So you're not partly to
blame. The dynamic was the same.
It's all the
yeah.
same. So
yeah.
then what happened in 1975
sure.
where it's like, okay, suddenly, you know, the mask is off and it's like, we're screwed.
Simply stated, the municipal bond market stopped funding New York City mm-hmm. municipal bonds. Municipal bonds were a great investment when everyone is making money and has taxes to pay because yep. they're triple tax free. So it's a good asset class when you want to mm-hmm. not pay a full income tax right. on the income. When, after a recession, you have a lot of losses, it mm-hmm. becomes a less attractive asset
right.
class. Now, because of the chicanery, which we can talk about in a second, New York had saturated the municipal bond market with its debt.
Mm-hmm.
It had, I think, over 25% of all municipal bonds were yeah. New York bonds.
It's amazing.
Given that portfolio diversification says never have more than 10% yeah. of any issuer in your
right.
asset class. And it was over 30% of short-term debt.
Yeah.
Now, people would park their money in short-term municipal bonds because they were tax-free and thought mm-hmm. to be safe. But when you have such an enormous saturation,
yeah.
you then have a problem, particularly in an asset class that's no longer as economically
right.
attractive. And one of the smart things Beame had done when he was controller in his first stint mm-hmm. was diversify the pension portfolios so that not all of their securities are invested in New York City
right.
securities. Something like 80% of New York mm-hmm. City pension funds invest in New York City securities. But when you divest that, you also yep. saturate the market.
Okay.
So you had that dynamic.
Okay. So the municipal bond market collapses for New York. Nobody wants to buy their bonds.
Right. So why was it so saturated? Mm-hmm. Well, because they were borrowing to do things they shouldn't yeah. be borrowing to do.
Right.
Now, you're not supposed to borrow to fund short-term expenses, ordinary right. course, annual expenses. You're only supposed to borrow long-term
right.
to finance bridges, schools, yeah. capital assets.
And you point out in the book, almost on every page, that New York was just like, we're not doing any capital improvements. We're
Correct.
Not. We're not maintaining anything. This
Correct.
Is all money that is going directly into somebody's pocket.
I think at one point at the peak, over 50% of all borrowings long-term for so-called capital assets were actually for ordinary expenses. Let
mm-hmm.
me give you an example. There was a fellow named James Cavanaugh, who was a mm-hmm. wonderful rogue from Brooklyn,
yeah.
who was, he never went to college. He was a genius at manipulating numbers, okay? Both in terms of showing fake layoffs
right.
and in terms in
yep.
showing fake. So he came up with an idea that said, no, wait a minute, teachers have an average career of 25 years, 30 years, whatever it is, and they do teacher training all the time, right? So isn't the useful life of that training a 30-year asset?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go in the bond market and borrow long-term to pay for teachers' salaries.
Wow.
Anybody looking at that ratchet is going to say that's
yeah.
nuts. He would do things like, okay, we need some short-term debt because we have a liquidity issue. Let's send out tax bills for embassies and churches and rectories and all kinds of things so that we can march it down to Salomon Brothers and other banks on Wall Street and do a bond issue backed by those income tax, those real estate tax receivables.
Right.
Which was all nonsense.
Right. They're not going to pay them.
No, but
yeah.
you hope to roll over
right.
into some real taxes
yeah.
later on to sort of refinance
yeah.
that. And in a low interest environment of the 60s, you could get away with that. But when interest rates spike, all of a sudden now the interest on what you borrowed in a phony way now becomes a real expense.
Yeah, which is happening on a macro level contemporaneously.
Correct.
In America.
They would do other things like, look, 5% of all Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements disallowed, right? For various duplicative and not covered. They would borrow 100 cents on the dollar in what they call RANs, revenue anticipation notes. You can borrow short term as long as you repay it during the year because a city's expenses are relatively even over the course of the year. Its revenues are lumpy.
Right.
So you can borrow against those to smooth it out. And of course, they abuse that in these ways.
Yeah. Okay. So the witching hour comes.
Correct.
And it's, you know, we're in 1975, the early part of 1975. It's clear New York is going to go bankrupt. It's going to default on its debt.
Correct. It was clear much earlier than that.
But I mean, this is when stuff gets moving, right?
Yeah.
And like Governor Hugh Carey.
Oh, the insiders knew it.
Governor Hugh Carey is, you know, one of the heroes of the book, if there is one.
I think there are, well, it depends what you mean by hero. The most effective players in terms of advancing their own interests would be Hugh Carey.
Right.
And I think he's a hero overall.
Yeah, but that's because he's Irish.
John Scanlon, who was a hero, but maybe not necessarily.
This is like, I feel like you're fighting the, you know, the Gangs of New York era wars or something.
Scanlon maybe was not the most honorable hero in the book, but in terms of being effective, he's wildly effective. I think Arthur Levitt is one of the real heroes.
All right. So in any case, in 1975, it becomes apparent that New York is going to need a federal bailout.
Correct.
And then the question is the timing, because essentially, if it happens before Thanksgiving of 1975, it is going to be on the federal government's term and Gerald Ford's terms in particular.
Correct.
If it happens after Thanksgiving, then Ford is running for re-election. Ford is running for re-election. And it's like he's going to do whatever he needs to in order to get 41 electoral votes from New York, which does turn out to be the difference between him winning or Carter winning, and Carter won.
And actually, it was New York City.
Yeah.
Because had Ford done as well as, or even slightly worse than Republicans typically did in New York City, he would have won New York State in the election.
Yeah.
He did historically bad. Only Alf Landon in 36 and Goldwater in 64 did worse.
Jeez. Okay. Yeah. So, and you, so Hugh Carey and Abe Beame. Abe Beame is the, you know, the kind of the first political figure I remember as somebody born in the early 60s. A total dweeb, a non-entity, an apparatchik. He was indistinguishable from a Soviet Kremlin member, right? kind of. Who was Abe Beame?
He escaped Russian communism.
Yeah, so
he,
it's like, ouch, I'm sorry for that comparison.
Okay.
But
it's
like, it turns out like, what was Abe Beame trying to do in order to save the
city? You
got to
understand, Abe Beame, his father escaped his father was a radical, escaping Tsarist oppression, and then escaping the, you know, the extreme politics of the Russian Empire in Poland in those days, escapes to London and then New York. And Abe Beame, as a young man, wandered into the Madison Democratic Club in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and decided he was going to be a Democrat.
Right.
He wanted to be an American and wanted to be involved in American politics. And that was the most powerful Democratic organization maybe in the country for the next generation or two.
And this was at a time, too, when the Democrats had taken over most of the big cities.
The Democrats did some smart things, okay? They decided they were not just going to be a party of the Irish. They became a party of the Irish and then the Jewish and then the Italians and then the Hispanics and then the Blacks.
Yeah.
So the Jews were moving to Brooklyn in very large numbers in the 1920s. And the Crown Heights Democratic Club needed to co-opt them. And Abe Beame came in and they said, here's a guy who we want.
All right, let's jump forward a couple of decades to bring Abe Beame. Is coming off, you know, he follows.
After licking envelopes for three decades, he finally gets his chance.
And John Lindsay 61. Had been the mayor right before him.
Yeah.
And then suddenly Abe Beame is the machine candidate, right?
Well, he was the machine candidate for controller in 61. Yeah. Then he was the machine candidate for mayor in 65 and lost in that famous election with Lindsay and Bill Buckley.
Yeah, right.
And then 69, he got his job back as controller. And then 73, he's again the nominee of the bosses of New York.
Right.
Maybe the last time there were bosses of New York was 73.
And I mean, so was he was good as a controller, right? In terms of like he knew how to
park money and stuff. He was a capable, competent guy.
Yeah.
But he came with that machine clubhouse politics mm-hmm. mentality.
Yeah.
He was sort of perhaps a bit too tolerant of corruption.
Sure.
He was a very pro-union guy. Mm-hmm. He was certainly very pro-civil rights guy. There are many things admirable about Abe Beame.
But he's not the guy you want running a city that's about to go bankrupt.
No, he is about as establishment and measured and not going to change things radically. Right.
And which is what's called for, because you have massive, massive outlays.
Well, he was quite the guy. He wanted to prove that that clubhouse system, which got the city in trouble to begin with, was actually the way to keep going into the late 20th and maybe 21st century.
Okay, so then he's working with Hugh Carey, who's also from Brooklyn, right? And is an Irish guy who was a long-term congressman.
Yeah, the Hugh Carey angle on this is very interesting, okay? Carey's career was becalmed in the early 1970s because he was supposed to be the whip.
Yeah.
He was supposed to get the job that went to Tip O'Neill.
Right.
But Hugh Carey could at times be aloof and moody, and he got stabbed in the back by two Irish congressmen from Brooklyn who resented him. And they went to Carl Alpert and to Hale Boggs and said, if you put Hugh in there, we're going to give you a hard time the way home.
Why didn't they like Hugh Carey?
Hugh Carey, he had a lot of money. His brother was one of the richest guys around.
Right.
And Hugh could afford to be independent.
Right.
Okay. And Hugh was a bit of, he was ambitious.
Yeah.
And he ran for mayor and he was clearly someone who viewed Congress as a stepping stone to greater things. And nobody likes rich, ambitious people who are successful.
Right. Yeah. He was also pretty tall too, right?
That he was tall. He was handsome. He was, look.
Yeah.
The guy had a very tough life.
Yeah.
He had 14 kids. His first wife was a widow whose husband died in the South Pacific.
I think his wife might have had the tougher job if he had 14 kids.
And then at 49 years old, with all these kids, she dies of breast cancer.
Yeah.
His brother dies in a plane crash.
Right.
Two of his kids die when he's running for mayor in a car wreck out on Shelter Island.
Mm-hmm.
So here he is now with all these kids, and he has the blow of being stabbed in the back and loses the whip seat. And he was basically thought to be done in 74 when he runs for governor. And he was not the favorite at all. Didn't get the nomination of the party.
Yeah.
But 74 was the best year to be an outsider.
Yeah.
Right? It was the Watergate year. The famous midterm election with the Democratic majorities were enormous. And Hugh, with the assistance of David Garth, a brilliant media man, ran his campaign, and his brother's millions ran perhaps the best gubernatorial primary campaign in New York history.
And he kind of anticipated a Reagan Democrat, right? Because he was
the last of that breed. Yeah,
yeah.
That was the last. That general, I guess Mario Cuomo's of that ilk too. But they sort of combined progressive politics with sort of the traditional values that still captured what ultimately became the MAGA base in a lot of ways.
Right, the public imagination.
Yeah.
They were very patriotic.
Yeah.
They constantly talked about America
Moynihan,
as a melting point.
Moynihan, I think, is from that ilk.
Yeah.
Tip O'Neill was from that ilk.
Yeah.
That's a lost breed.
Carey and Beame, what did they do to kind of string Ford out as long as possible?
Yeah. It was clear by the fall of 74 that the city was going to go broke in 75. And that a bailout was needed, and the state had its own fiscal issues. Couldn't do it.
Right.
So they knew the money was going to come. Everybody knew the money was going to come from Washington.
And the money was going to come from Washington because New York mattered
41 electoral votes.
So much politically.
So many people took credit
for
saving New York.
Yeah.
What saved New York was its 41 electoral votes.
And it was never in question. I mean, part of your this book is a revisionist account.
Yeah.
Of the fiscal
truthful
crisis
account.
In New York. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Where, everybody knew a federal bailout was coming. And you point out, the book is called Drop Dead because of the famous Daily News headline.
John Scanlon's
City,
finest
Drop
moment.
Dead.
Yeah.
That speech, Gerald Ford said, I'm going to bail out New York.
But here are my conditions.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that gets twisted into Drop Dead.
Brilliant.
Not at all.
Yeah.
But so everybody knew it was coming.
Correct.
Okay, so what did they do to string them out as long as
possible? Well, you got to understand the dynamic here. Ford decides he wants to run for president, even though he told Nixon he didn't. Once you're in the White House, you kind of like living there. But he had a problem. He had Ronald Reagan, who was going to challenge him for the nomination.
Right.
And Ronald Reagan had the support of the conservative base of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Ford chose Nelson Rockefeller to be his vice president.
Right.
So if you're trying to fend off a challenge from the right as a Republican running for president, and your running mate at the time is the most liberal Republican in the
country.
And
the guy who got booted, you know, who lost the nomination in 64 to Goldwater because,
and then
you
split
know,
the party.
Rockefeller is the liberal Republican, right? The country club Republican.
And now you are going to have to bail out New York City.
The
hub of all evil.
Yeah, where Nelson Rockefeller was
governor
of New York, et cetera.
So Ford saying himself, oh, great. Yeah, and remember, Ford's Secretary of the Treasury was Bill Simon, who ran the municipal bond desk at Salomon Brothers. So he was very well informed what this was all going to be about. So Ford said, okay, I've got to walk a very thin line here.
Yeah.
If I am perceived to be too generous to New York, Reagan is going to use that against me and maybe beat me. And remember that nomination fight went all the way to the convention floor. It's the last convention that ever mattered, frankly.
Right,
On the other hand, if he was too hard on New York, the Republican delegates from New York might bolt.
Right.
And the first event of the 1976 presidential season was the Republican convention, which back then chose about a third of the delegates on January 6, 1976.
Yeah.
See, the Republicans were making this transition from the old system, where most delegates were chose overwhelming majority by conventions.
Right.
And the open primary system.
Right.
So they still held back a few.
Yeah.
And if those Republicans on January 6th were upset with Ford because he raked the city over the coals, they could have withheld their approval, which would have been big news.
Yeah.
The vice president is on the ticket.
Yeah.
New Yorker, the titular head of the party.
Right.
The party revolts. Next you have Iowa, next you have New Hampshire. Yeah. That could have been it for Ford.
Right.
So Ford had to hold on to those, which he ultimately did.
Yeah.
But that required him to also not be draconian in how he dealt with New York.
Right.
So he thought he was walking that line very well. And he knew that if he didn't get it over with, if people went into the Thanksgiving, Christmas holidays in New York thinking the city was going to be in default, the resentment against Ford would have been overwhelming.
Right.
So Tip O'Neill came up with a strategy. He figured this out and said, Ford's going to want this over by Thanksgiving. That was Tip's conclusion right away. So he basically said to Kerry, if you can find the money to keep the city running through Thanksgiving, Ford will cave.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, exactly what happened.
Yeah. So talk about the myths that have arisen about how, you know, who saved New York.
It's a very long list of people who saved New York.
Let's start with the one named Felix.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Who is Felix Rowatin?
Felix Rowatin was perhaps the greatest investment banker maybe of all time, to give him his due. Yep. An incredibly capable guy, energetic, a Rolodex better than, you know, anyone you could imagine. But he had aspirations. He was a frustrated politician. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be Secretary of the Treasury or head of the Federal Reserve. Right. He ultimately had to settle for Ambassador to France.
Right,
not so bad.
That's kind of an insult.
But he had those ambitions.
Yeah.
And he was doing very well for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He was in front of Congress in the antitrust hearings of Manny Seller in the late 60s.
Right.
He was chosen by the New York Stock Exchange to go out and get their bailout in 1970. Mm-hmm. And then he stubbed his toe. There was the AT&T scandal where there was alleged bribe.
Explain what AT&T was.
Yeah, there was a DOJ investigation of antitrust violations, other violations. And Felix went down to Washington to try to sort of, Harold Janine was his biggest client, AT&T. He went down there, smoothed it over, and there were later allegations that they were briberies. Nothing tied Felix to any of this, but the taint of being associated with that.
And AT&T was one of these kind of shadowy mega
conglomerates,
reaches all over the
world. All the conspiracy theory
involved
nonsense,
in the Chilean overthrow of Allende, et cetera.
Right. So Felix was tainted in the mid-70s. They called him Felix the Fixer, which is not quite chairman of the Federal Reserve moniker.
Yeah.
So he wanted to undo that. And when he saw what was coming down the pike in New York in 75, he said to himself, if I can be useful in this, and this, you know, works out reasonably well for New York, I could rehabilitate my reputation.
Yeah.
Of course, he did it brilliantly.
Yeah.
And he volunteered a lot of time, was very effective. So I don't want to diminish his public service.
Right.
But the idea that his brainchild, the Municipal Assistance Corporation, saved New York is just factually unsupportable.
Which is the thesis of the documentary that's out now, Drop
Correct.
Dead City,
Correct.
Co-directed by his son.
Right.
Which is, you know,
I'd
of course.
I'd be loyal to my father, too. You know, but I'd put the best spin on it. But the fact of the matter was, the Municipal Assistance Corporation was formed over the Labor Day week, over the Memorial Day weekend, to bridge the gap so that oversaturation could get soaked up and the city could access the municipal bond market again in September.
Right.
It was supposed to sell $3 billion of bonds, tied the city over, and then in the interim, they would fix the budget, get rid of the corruption in the budgeting process, and the market would accept New York securities again. Of course, it took 4 or 5 years for the city to access the municipal bond market.
And it's interesting.
And the MAC only sold $1 billion of bonds.
Right.
They were going to do 3 offerings. Only one was sold. The other two
because
floundered.
Nobody would buy them.
Because the market saw through it. This isn't like some separate credit. It's the same New York City credit and a moral obligation of the state of New York, which the state reneged on its moral obligation when the UDC went under earlier in the year.
It is, you know, whenever, and it's easier to say this with hindsight, but if Nelson Rockefeller is invoking moral obligation, you should run as far as possible, right? You know, from whatever he's talking about.
There are some things about Rocky I admire. He was a great politician.
Yeah. Loved art.
Loved art.
Yeah, yeah.
Was quite a character in his own right.
For sure, for sure.
But the Municipal Assistance Corporation, while a useful vehicle after the bailout was obtained and the city was stabilized, had virtually nothing to do with stabilizing
the
city.
Why do you think so many people are invested in the idea that, you know, what happened was... You know, and I think Richard Brody in The New Yorker reviewing Drop Dead City talked about how, you know, whatever else you can say about it, this documentary is a pay-in to liberal governance. Like when, you know, governments really did the things they needed to do for their citizens. And it's a shame, you know, something, something happened. And like, you
Because
the city
they can't
was
help
bankrupt.
Themselves. The sort of elitist, you know, left-leaning, I don't want to get overly political here, but they love that notion because they themselves are elites. They all went to the fancy boarding schools. They go to the same book parties. Mm. They want nothing more than one of their own to be a hero in effectively a government, you know, overreach, I would say.
Yeah. And so they, you know, the idea of like a government that does everything for everybody is good. And then the people who make that
and
viable.
And if our people are the heroes, that's
now,
ideal.
One of the things that is amazing in the book you talk about is that, you know, from 1975 to 1978, the budget of New York City grew by 20%. So this is in the most austere of austerity periods ever.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the ways in which, you know, people, like jobs were not actually cut.
Correct.
Budgets were not actually cut.
Correct.
How does this happen?
Sure. Well, it's very simple. Let's take the most extreme example. When Beam announced his layoffs in 75, when you actually parse through it, very few people actually lost paychecks. Right. They would claim not internships, unpaid internships. We've laid people off. We got rid of those. A program where position is not filled yet.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't fill them.
Right.
More layoffs. We move job classifications from a city-funded program to a federal program. Mm-hmm. Job loss.
Yeah.
Well, no. The cash outlays have not changed at all. So that was one trick they used early on. Then what you saw was, after 75 and going further, the union contracts continued to effectively get even better.
Right.
Now, they did lose some headcount, but most of the headcount losses were the low-paid entry-level folks.
Right.
So the people who run the unions obviously take care of themselves.
And you point out that that means disproportionately it was minorities and women or
minorities
younger
and women
it's always
suffered the most.
Yeah, the most recently hired or the first
and
fired.
It was the established white males who ended up getting larger pay increases.
Right.
You also had cuts in services to the most needy.
Mm-hmm.
So where there was real austerity, it was in chest X-ray programs, for example, which were done away
in
with.
Like hospitals in the Bronx,
correct?
Right?
Special education programs.
Yeah.
People who don't have lobbyists, people who don't have unions representing. Yeah. Those programs got decimated.
Now, one of the things that's fascinating, though, is that, you know, later in the 70s, the guy who succeeds Abe Beam is Ed Koch.
Right.
Fights off Mario Cuomo in a very tight runoff.
Famous 77 mayoral campaign.
I believe is it by 1978 that the the city has balanced the budget?
A little later than that. But what happened
like,
was...
What did they do to actually get back to some kind of budget normalcy?
Yeah, well, the 75 bill was to fix the short-term debt. Everybody knew there was going to need to be another one. In 78, the federal government came in again.
Right.
But this time, there was no conflict.
Right.
Carter with the Democratic Congress were all in favor of it.
Right.
They had a signing ceremony on the steps of City Hall. But there was still a structural deficit and still financing issues.
Yeah.
The city still could not borrow in a normal way. It accessed the market again by 79, but not in a robust way. Okay. And then in an office.
But, and by the way, I mean, not being able to sell your debt should be a budget disciplinary action, right?
Well, that, unless the federal government can.
I mean, it's like if I'm a person and nobody will give me credit.
Not if
like
the federal government will bail you out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So what happened was a transformation of the American economy by way of the financial services industry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The share of the economy, which was the financial services industry, basically went up by 50% over the course of a decade and a half.
Right.
And all, not all of it, but the vast majority of that wealth and tax revenue flowed into New York City.
Right.
So the hero is Michael Milken.
Right.
Right.
Who's working out of, you know,
Avenue
Southern California in the morning and everything.
In Century City, correct.
Yeah. But he, you know, and it's fascinating because if people still remember him, they know he's the junk bond king who went to federal prison and had to, you know, had to take his toupee off and everything.
Right.
But you say he's the hero of like New York's robust recovery.
I said he's the felon that represents the ascendancy of New York when Tony Scotto, the union leader, is the felon that represents its demise.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some truth to that. I think the resurgence of that industry and the resurgence of Wall Street beginning in the, you know, 1980, really, and continuing until, you know, knock on wood now,
is really
what saved New York City.
It is amazing when you look back at New York. I mean, and in 1975, was that the actual year of the Fear City pamphlets?
Where
the police
Which, again, was, you know, you got to understand what was going on there. Okay. Abe Beame was negotiating with Warren Anderson, the Republican Senate leader, to get more money for the city.
Yeah.
And there were seven Republican state senators in New York City who were at risk of bolting, okay? So Warren Anderson had to placate them. So those Republican districts were pretty much white, pretty much middle class, very much focused on law and order. So the unions knew if they could scare the bejesus out of those in those seven districts by saying the city's going to devolve into chaos and mayhem in the streets, that Warren Anderson would cave and give the city more money.
Yeah.
So Abe Beame was aware of and probably complicit in the in the Fear City. He but, waves it in front of the who waves something in front of the camera that they don't want
that the police produced
handed out at the airports and the Midtown hotels, saying, "Be careful, tourists in New York City. You'll get mugged and raped and beaten up."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Later becomes an Iggy Pop album.
Right.
So.
Correct. And that was one of the tactics used by the city insiders to put pressure on the state
so
to get more money.
You
and
go,
it worked.
You go from that to, you know, 10 years later, certainly by 1987, which I think is the year that Bonfire of the Vanities comes out. And Tom Wolfe is talking about the masters of the universe. And New York's economy, which compared to now is nothing, but it was like, it was unbelievable.
Oh, we thought people that made $100 million a year were wealth beyond your imagination.
$100,000 a year.
$100 million. Yeah. We thought when Michael Milken made $500 million a year one year, people thought this was the most outrageous thing. Now, if you run a major major private equity fund, that's a normal year's paycheck.
So— let's update this now because the you know the lengthy subtitle of your book, which actually takes six or seven pages to read, but it is you know how New York went back to business as usual, and it might be happening again.
Yeah.
If you look at recent appraisals of the New York City budget, both by people within the government and watchdog organizations, they all say the same thing, that since 2023, fiscal 2023, the city has been spending more than it's taking in on an annual basis.
Yeah.
Some of that, there's been a surplus because during COVID, a lot of money from the feds, et cetera, came to the cities and states.
Yes.
If you look down the road in, what is it, the city five-year plan forecast deficits of $11 billion in 2027, $13 billion in 2028, $13 billion again in 2029.
And that's before. I haven't seen a comprehensive analysis yet of what the big bad bill, big beautiful bill.
You're right.
BBB. I call it BBB because that's what the city's credit rating is going to be once people go through.
Okay, you're right. Because is that going to take money away from the
yes,
city?
Yes, just and the state.
Right.
And it's unclear how much.
Yeah. So are we back to where we were in maybe not 1975, but 1971, 72?
Well, let's talk about the two things that caused New York to have a fiscal crisis when other large cities didn't. One was the chicanery. Now, we don't know what's going on there. You only learn about that after the fact. Two is the city taking on more responsibilities and obligations than other cities do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we have a Democratic nominee right now who says that he wants to increase universal child care through 6 years old.
Right.
Well, that's going to cost you $10 billion. You want to give away free bus service. That's going to add $1 billion. You want to add 4% to the business corporate income tax.
Right.
What's that going to do in terms of businesses leaving? You want to have a surplus of 2% income tax surcharge on millionaires who, you know, in New York City, millionaire, you're doing quite fine, but, you know, you're not exactly a master of the universe anymore.
Or let's be more clear about it. $1 million is a lot of money. You're doing well in New York or anywhere else. The difference really is that the financial industry is not anchored here in the way that it used to be.
Well, that's the wild card. Right? Correct. Remember, what happened in 75 was the culmination of well-paying industrial jobs leaving. And they left because they could.
Right.
And there were lower taxes and lower wage rates. We thought for a very long time you had to be in New York City.
Right.
And for years you did, back when there was no interstate branch banking.
If I may, I remember my parents talking about, you know, they had been living in New York for decades. My father was born in Hell's Kitchen in the 20s. Mm-hmm. But when California, I remember them saying, when California surpassed New York as the most populous state, they said everybody in New York was like, oh, don't worry about it. Everybody wants to be in New York City.
Right.
It will come back.
Yeah.
And then flash forward 10 years later, you know, politicians have been saying the same thing. And it was, it's never coming back.
Well, remember, before trading became effectively electronic, you traded stocks in the New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
You to be a member of the New York Stock Exchange, you had to have an office in Lower Manhattan. Before unfettered into interstate branch commercial banking, you know, you had to have deposits in New York State. The big banks had to be. That's all gone now.
Right.
You can literally pull the plug on Friday, and people have, and replug in Palm Beach or Austin, Texas on Monday seamlessly.
And, you know, in the 70s and 80s, certainly, you could also defect. Like, you could still work in New York, but you'd move to Connecticut or New Jersey, which were tax havens by comparison, no longer true.
Oh, maybe with Mr. Mondami in there, it may be, you may see that.
Yeah, but it won't be because they're reducing their taxes. It's just that it'll be lower than if they
lived in New York City.
We can talk about, you know, Mamdani as a threat. Isn't it worth also talking about, I mean, you know, the people he's running against? And at this point, it looks like Andrew Cuomo and Eric Adams, the incumbent mayor. And Curtis Sliwa. But I mean, is he a factor? But What went wrong that gave Mamdani, you know, a clear path to the Democratic Party nomination?
Yeah, I think that Andrew Cuomo was perceived by the Democratic primary voter to be less energizing, inspirational, what have you, than Mr. Mamdani. He also ran a very safe and conservative campaign, almost akin to a Rose Garden campaign, that took very few chances and tried to win by getting the endorsement of as many community leaders, business leaders, and running an air campaign and hoping for a low turnout, I think, a low turnout primary. And out of nowhere comes Mr. Mamdani, who then, you know, links arms with Brad Lander, and he peaks at just the right time, and gets the, you know, 500,000 votes that are necessary to win the Democratic primary.
Are people wrong? And I realize, you know, we're talking about a Democratic primary, so it's a subset of, you know, Democratic voters in New York, which is a subset of voters in New York.
Not really. You got 1,000,001 votes in this primary. Yeah. The last two generals were around that same amount.
Andrew Cuomo, you know, left office in disgrace, presided terribly over New York State. You know, he was terrible on COVID policy.
Yeah,
and
on
lied
law and
about
order.
It. Yeah, he was not good on that. He was, you know, he came in. It sounded like he was going to undo his father's terrible legacy of just blowing out the budget in New York and raising taxes.
Yep.
He didn't do any of that.
Correct.
So, I mean, the voters are right to repudiate somebody like Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah.
What about Eric Adams? Is Eric Adams then like the last least bad alternative, or
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I've made it clear that I'm going to support Eric Adams.
Yeah,
I think Eric Adams has turned the corner a lot of ways. I think
what does that mean?
He's demanding
first class upgrades on Turkish Airlines as opposed to just a couple hours.
I think he was
lounge.
Guilty of excessive loyalty to longtime personal friends and put them in positions of power, particularly in law enforcement, where obviously he started his career in politics. And that came back to bite him very quickly.
Yeah.
And I think he, by putting Randy Mastro in as first deputy mayor and Ms. Titian as police commissioner, I think he has shown that he has learned those lessons.
Yeah.
If this had happened a year earlier and he had had 2 years of Mastro and Tish, I think he would be a much more formidable candidate.
Why does New York City so regularly generate mediocre citywide politicians? You know, if you take out Bloomberg, who as a good libertarian, I was bothered by many of his nanny state stuff, but like everybody I talk to in New York of all different levels, like everybody, you know, everybody is libertarian here. Everybody is tolerant and pluralistic, and everybody just wants the garbage collected,
it's a very odd thing, and business able
to function.
Yeah.
You know, why aren't there Bloombergs falling off of trees as opposed to it's more likely that you get an Eric Adams, Bill de Blasio, a late stage, you know, Rudy Giuliani problem.
Because I think most people don't want to spend their entire lives in municipal government, particularly elective office. And in order to get your hands on the apparatus to get elected, unless you are a Bloomberg and you can write a check for $50 million, it's very hard to parachute in and do that.
Right.
So the things that motivate those people, and I agree, that's most New Yorkers. I mean, this is why it's been so economically successful for 400 years, because it attracts people with that entrepreneurial instinct who want to be left alone, who don't care about your race, creed, religion, et cetera. What can you do for me?
Right.
In a very good way.
Yeah, yeah.
Those people are not attracted to serving in the city council by and large.
Because that's how you really do have to do time and move up.
Correct. Correct.
And then if you do that, though, then you're beholden to all of the people who helped you along the way.
In order to make the several billion that Mike Bloomberg had when he ran for mayor, you got to do something else. And making that transition is sometimes difficult because of the resentments and other things that come into play.
Are there large cities that you think are governed well that New York should look to as alternatives?
No, let's rattle off the list. Would you say L.A., Chicago, Boston?
Maybe Houston. Houston's growing.
I don't know as much about Houston as I
mean,
should.
The cities in Texas are all growing, but this is where you never know how much, like, you know, how much of what's happening is it because of local politics or state politics or national politics or global politics.
Remember that we had to suffer through 40 years in order to get Giuliani.
Yeah.
And then 50 years in order to get Bloomberg, really.
Is this the – are we entering a large cycle perhaps? Not to sound like Oswald Spengler, but, you know, New York has these boom periods that last for 50 or 75 years. And then they start – I mean, New York under Wagner. Yeah, I mean, you can see it in relief, you know, and looking backwards. Like, yeah, okay, this ship was clearly headed for the iceberg, you know, the coordinates were locked in decades before it happened.
You could say going back to O'Dwyer.
Yeah.
So O'Dwyer's second term was maybe the start of the decline.
So, and is that just, you know, this is just a process of kind of, you know, collapse and renewal?
I don't go for these sort of cycles of history.
Right.
I think it's too simplistic.
Can I ask, are you a registered Republican?
No, I'm a registered Democrat.
Registered Democrat, okay. Yeah. But What can the Republican Party do, either at the increasingly at the state level, but also at the city level?
I think there's a major opportunity for the Republican Party in New York. I think there's been historically high migration of Black and Hispanic, particularly male voters, to the National Republican Party. I mean, Trump, like it or not, did...
No, he gained with every, basically every demographic group, but larger among Black men and Hispanic men.
If you look at recent immigrants and Hispanics and others and middle-class Blacks, these are people who are in favor of smaller government, lower taxes, entrepreneurial, traditional values, which I know is not necessarily a libertarian thing, but it certainly is more aligned with the Republican platform these days than the Democrat. These are not woke constituencies.
Yeah,
you know, I find it encouraging in this most recent Democratic primary that the non-white candidate won the white vote and the white candidate won the Black vote. So
what's going on with that? Because Mamdani also did very well among higher income people.
And higher educated white people.
Is that just white guilt?
No.
What is it then?
I think it's an ideological shift.
Okay.
We talk about affordability.
Yeah.
Okay. And housing is where it's most it's focused on. And they say, "Gee, I'm 28 years old. I can't afford a house, but my grandparents could. My parents. Well, I think back to my parents. Okay. And they rented a house for 2 years. And these were teachers. These were not impoverished people." And they saved every penny. There was no vacation. There was no new clothes. There was no, you know, nothing fancy. They didn't have an air conditioner.
Yeah.
And they saved their money. They got a down payment. And owning the home was their priority because that was the marker of being successful in America. Right. I'm not a renter. I'm an owner. Yeah. I'm going to do whatever it takes. And it turned out to be foolish economically. Right. But my father repaid his mortgage in 5 years.
Yeah, but...
In 64, just in time for the LBJ interest rates to start going out. He'd taken the mortgage payments and invested in treasuries, he would have been better off. But that was the mentality. Yeah. And that was the priority.
Is it?
You can't say, okay, I buy the latest iPhone immediately.
Right.
I have the fancy clothes and the vacations and the Instagram and this and that and the other thing. But how come I don't have the money to buy a house?
Is it
and
ideological?
I don't want a house in Nutley, New Jersey.
Is it?
I want a nice house in Park Slope. Yeah.
Is it ideological or generational? Because when
I think
about
I also think, look, my mind wasn't poisoned by this Marcusean higher education. Mm-hmm. It was there, but they were the crazies in the humanities department. Everybody ignored them.
And you're 59, you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, is part of it that, you know, the people who are under 40 or under 45, say, have grown up in an incredibly rich country, which we don't acknowledge. Generally speaking.
Correct.
So if you're second, third, fourth generation going to college, if you you are, even if you have student debt, you're living in a different world than people who remember moving every 6 months because the rent can't be paid. And so you move further out into Brooklyn or Queens or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the bemoaning of affordability relative to the standard of living is, you know, is quite shocking.
Are there any Republicans, though, because and we'll end on this. You know, you talked about, you know, older candidates talking about New York as this great American experiment. This, you know, this might have died with David Dinkins talking about the glorious mosaic as opposed to the melting pot in the in the 80s. But, you know, the idea that New York is a place you come where you'll be accepted. You know, you might not be liked, but you'll be tolerated and you can make it. You can find people who will help you and you'll create your own world. You know, who on the Republican side of things, you know, certainly nationally, but also locally, is acting that way? Because that seems to me something that's the opportunity, right? To tell people who don't look
like
your grandparents.
I think someone like a Marco Rubio could make that argument. And I think does from time to time.
Yeah. Noticeably less so than when he emerged, you know, in the beginning of the
Trump.
Teens.
Yep.
Trump is busy sending people escaping socialism in Venezuela back to Venezuela with a vacation in El Salvador.
I think it's a bad look. Look, I'm sympathetic to having borders and getting rid of people who are lawbreakers.
Absolutely.
But the visual...
But not workers, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But
I'm saying in New York...
He's deporting future Republicans, by the way. These people, a lot of them are going to be hardworking, contributing
members
of society.
Oh, wait until they see how poorly run the prisons in Venezuela are. They're going to be lifelong Republicans.
Yep.
But in New York City, are there, you know, is there a constituency for that? You know what is great about New York is that everybody is kind of weird and different.
I think they're out there. I think if you get a... a Dominican, a billionaire, and I'm sure there are some, and will be more, who wants to do what Bloomberg did. I love the city. I want to make a huge difference. I can. I have credibility with immigrant groups. Yeah. I think that immigrant story is as vibrant as it's ever been.
Yeah.
And I don't think we necessarily know who that is now.
Right.
But I think there is clearly a market demand for that.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to leave it there. The book is Drop Dead. The author is Richard Farley. The subtitle, I'm not going to repeat it because
it's
too long.
Time.
But this is fascinating because it's about a particular epic moment in urban history that's within memory, but it's totally forgotten, but might be happening again. So thank you, Richard, for writing this book.
Well, I hadn't lived a wholesome enough life to deserve Mondami to come out right when the book was launching last month, but here we are.
Thank you.